welcome to the first ever live Blood Ties podcast. I'm Molly Wonsell, and I'm here with my father, Jeffrey Wonsell.
Hello, everyone. Welcome. Thank you for all for coming. It's wonderful to see you, especially on a bit of a bleak old night.
Really sorry. Betsy's so excited. Probably half the people in the audience she knows. So if I let you off, will you go and run around? Okay. She might come and say hi to you. yeah, that's the informal nature of this podcast record. There will be a dog wandering around most of the time.
How's your week, Mo?
Yes, fine. Been preparing for said podcast, so it's been good and busy. You know, it's December, so it's a bit hectic.
My week, my head is spinning, really, for this week. It's been all over the place. I've been in Cardiff, I've been in London, and I'm now doing this. It's a delight. But my goodness, it's been an extraordinary week. But that's wonderful. No, how can anyone possibly not enjoy seeing
murder.
A lovely audience like this, a great audience, and also not enjoy murder? Well, I spend my life pretty much doing murder, but two books, not doing it.
Yeah. It's not something you haven't told us, Dad.
No, I haven't told myself. But two books, I always try and recommend a book or two every time I do these. And I have two. One is a book by Professor Angela Gallup, who was one of the forensic scientists who worked on the Ripper, Yorkshire Ripper, and on Damilola Taylor and on Stephen Lawrence. And it's being published in paperback by Hodder in January, which is an extraordinary description of what it's like. And the other one is by an old friend, David Ambrose. It's called A Fate Worse Than Hollywood. And he became a very successful screenwriter, and he's a friend, both of which I heartily recommend. But I don't know. I recommend my own work too, I think.
Yes, no, and you can buy copies of Jeffrey's book here, which is, you know, we might as well plug you as you're the important person, the talent.
I don't ever believe that.
That's very true. Yeah, I don't have much other exciting stuff. Apart from getting ready for
well,
the end of
this
the
is
year.
Such a wonderful event. I mean, we've never done a live one. I've done two or three live ones before, but not about this particular story. And I've always enjoyed them. It's very warm. It's very intimate. And what I wanted to do today was to try and tell you a story that I think and I hope might move you.
We should just preface that neither of us are experts.
I should say at once, I'm not a ripperologist. There may be some in the audience in which, please forgive me if I get some things wrong, but
yeah, we'll open up to questions at the end.
At the end, of course.
Call us out on anything.
And then you can correct me. but what I would say, and why we wanted to do this in Bethnal Green, which is the closest we could get to Whitechapel, because these are the Whitechapel murders, so perhaps we should...
We should get going. Okay, well, everyone, here we go. Jack the Ripper.
It's perhaps worth beginning with something very simple. When the murders in Whitechapel began to happen in 1888, there was no mention of Jack the Ripper. In the Scotland Yard files, they were called the Whitechapel murders. And indeed, there's a great deal of speculation about at what point there was a Jack the Ripper or there wasn't. So let's begin in Whitechapel. It's 1888. It's 1 year after Queen Victoria's Golden Jubilee. The East End, particularly Whitechapel, is a melting pot. The Irish famine has sent lots of Irish immigrants. The pogroms in Poland have sent lots of Polish immigrants. It's a very Jewish community. Literally, less than a mile from where we're sitting here tonight.
I'm going to get my dog. She's been badly behaved.
The dog had nothing to do with anything.
Okay.
What the East End was at that point, because it was so near the docks, when people fled, whether it was from Germany or Poland or indeed Ireland, they often landed in what were then the docks. I know there are no docks there, there are only docklands. They landed and they didn't move very far. If you look at the pattern of living in the East End at that point, it was an incredibly intense community. Add into that, there were very few gas lights. There was no electricity, of course. There was an incredible level of deprivation. Poverty ruled. The streets were cobbled, there were alleyways. Women fought to survive. And it would be fair to say that to be a woman in the East End at that point in 1888 was incredibly tough. You probably had an alcoholic problem. You probably didn't have enough money to survive. And so you had very, very few alternatives. One of them was to sell yourself. No one should condemn that. It was a way of surviving. At one point in 1888, the Metropolitan Police Service, as it then was, estimated there were 62 brothels and 1,200 sex workers, as we now call them, working in Whitechapel, an area of less than a square mile. These were women who wanted to survive. I could not be more forgiving. But into that mix in 1888 was introduced a murderer. And that's really what this podcast is about. We have alleyways, gaslights, no one knows what's happening, and women are propositioning men literally as though it's obvious, because they need to pay the fourpence that it's going to cost them for a room that night. So they might say, well, sixpence, and that helps them get through.
We've talked before, haven't we, about how it's possible to, well, how it can, you target vulnerable members of society.
You do, but one of the things about this particular series of killings is that, was it about the women or was it about something more complicated?
I feel like you're going to tell me.
Well, I'm going to try. Those of you who know the cases well will know that there were 11 Whitechapel murders. There's always been a dispute about which ones were committed by so-called Jack the Ripper and which ones weren't. The first two Whitechapel murders, which are in the Metropolitan Police's file, were a girl called Emma Smith in April and Martha Tabram in August. Emma Smith was attacked on the 3rd of April, but it was very unlike the later attacks. She was robbed and sexually assaulted by a group of men, she said later, one of whom was a teenager, and something was unpleasant was inserted into her, and she caught peritonitis and died the following day. I've never thought that Emma Smith was a victim of the Ripper. Tabram was attacked and killed on the 7th of August. She had 39 stab wounds, but she was stabbed, and this becomes important, rather than slashed. And one of the Ripper's signatures was slashing. Most of the really significant Ripper experts don't consider her one of what is known in the trade as the canonical five. There were 11 Whitechapel murders. Two were committed before what were to become called the canonical five, and then there were four committed post. Now, I will say tonight, and I absolutely believe it, we do not know. There's incredible amount of disagreement about who did what, when, precisely what the DNA links, what the links were. But the important point is that at that point, in early August 1888, there was no sense. The name Jack the Ripper had never been uttered. Two women had been murdered. They were both sex workers, as we'd now call them. But there was no sense of there being a serial killer at work. It wasn't until later in August 1888 that the first of the so-called canonical five was killed.
Why are they called the canonical five?
I think it's the Ripperologist. I'm not going to claim any...
What does canonical mean?
Well, it means they are regarded as the most significant five.
Oh, okay.
There's been a great deal of debate, which I will come back to, I promise you. Mary Ann, always known as Polly Nichols, was killed on the night of Friday, the 31st of August. Her throat was cut. There's a great deal of debate, and forgive me, some of you may well be really expert ripperologists than this, but there's a debate about whether she was cut from right to left or left to right. At one point, one of the pathologists suggested that the Ripper was left-handed. That has subsequently been disregarded. But there's always been a debate about whether he attacked them that way or that way. But suffice to say, it's 20 to 4 in the morning of Friday the 31st of August. Now, this is significant because, as we'll come to see, she was, quotes, discovered by a meat carter, a man who delivered carcasses and wore an apron, which is often blood-spattered.
They work early in the morning.
He summoned another, a man called Robert Paul, who summoned a police officer. As I will come back to later, there's a great deal of debate about exactly how accurate his description of what happened was. He said, oh, I only got here 2 minutes ago. And yet, if you look back at the timeline, he may well have been there for perhaps 7 or even 9 minutes. When the man he summoned, called Robert Paul, first saw Polly Nichols, there was no real blood pool. By the time the police officer got there, there was a substantial blood pool. She had been brutally attacked. Her skirt was lifted up around her waist. Her throat had been cut. The lower part of her abdomen, and this is one of the most horrifying things of all these crimes, had been sliced open, a jagged cut. The police officer, who, remember, only had one of those wonderful bulldog lights, because remember, there was no street lights.
Oh, yeah, they wouldn't be able to see anything.
Couldn't see anything, shone the light on Polly Nichols' body and was utterly horrified. There were other incisions in Polly's body. But let's be realistic. Polly was, well, yes, she wasn't, how can I put it, of the nobility. She was trying to survive as best she possibly could, and had her life taken away.
Did people not pay that much attention then, or did they pay attention because it was so brutal?
I don't think so at that point, darling.
But it wasn't until more...
I mean, I think it's the same point that if you look at Peter Sutcliffe, the Yorkshire Ripper, in the 1980s, if you lose sex workers...
That's what I mean about vulnerable members of society.
Of course.
It's like the homeless. People do... That's happened before.
Well, we've
done that on a podcast before.
I've just been reading a book about someone who kills homeless people. They are vulnerable. They are
bedtime reading for you.
Yeah.
Sorry.
Barely 8 days later. And I mean, I should say at once that Polly Nichols was a mother of 5 children.
Oh no.
We're not talking about, you know, you think nowadays of escorts, and they're very young. She wasn't a young woman. The next victim, Annie Chapman, on Saturday, the 8th of September, 1888, was 45. She had 3 kids.
Were they all mothers?
Yes, except the last one. Same thing. Her throat was slashed. Again, her abdomen had been opened. And in this case, as in one of the other cases, her uterus had been removed. This was to cause the police a considerable complication, because they thought, it was believed, that, well, it must be some kind of man with surgical experience or a doctor or whatever. That was later to be questioned. But Annie Chapman was literally an ordinary woman trying to do the best to sustain herself and her children in the East End at a time of great poverty. I am not in any way suggesting that these people, these ladies, should be condemned. They absolutely and utterly shouldn't. They were doing their best to survive in a very complex situation. The second murder, yes, it caused a certain amount of consternation in what was then called H Division, of the Metropolitan Police Service.
What's H Division?
For Whitechapel.
H for Whitechapel?
No, it was just the H they got. I love it.
Not W Division.
No, not the W Division, no. H Division began to take it seriously. After all, this is two murders, and remember there were two before which might have been linked. There was a suspicion in Whitechapel at that point that all four, Emma Smith, Martha Tabram, Polly Nichols and Annie Chapman, were all together.
Did they know each other? We don't know that.
We don't know. Okay. One of the questions I'm going to ask at the end...
Okay.
Is one of the things that they didn't do in those days is what we now call victimology.
Oh, yeah.
In other words, nobody sat down and said,
did they know each other?
Did they know each other? Were there connections?
Other than the fact they were all sex workers, there was no connection.
Or had they all lived in a particular workhouse?
That would have been really helpful if they had done that.
Well, yes, even Inspector Abilene, who enters the story soon.
No, I just mean it's fair enough they don't have forensics and DNA and stuff like that then, but, that would have been possible and helpful.
Yeah, but no one did what we would now immediately say, where's the victimology?
No one behavioralised the serial killer.
There was no behavioural science unit, the FBI.
Yeah.
There was nothing, and the Metropolitan Police Service, to pay it a great credit, did their very best. Okay. 3 weeks pass. We're now at the end of September 1888. And there's what's called, in this case, the double event. Two women are discovered murdered on the same night. It's Sunday, the 30th of September, 1888. Anyone who knows the story knows it better than I. They were... Elizabeth Stride was discovered at 1 a.m. and Catherine Eddowes was discovered at 1:45. Both had been brutally attacked. Some people doubt that Stride had been killed by the same person. Her throat had been cut, but there is a suggestion that her killer may have been disturbed and there were no mutilations to the abdomen or to the genitals. Catherine Eddowes, however, was brutally mutilated. Again, her abdomen had been ripped open. Her left kidney had been removed, as had part of her uterus.
Maybe he was disturbed because it might be that sort of thing where you're on a frenzy or a killing spree. She said, you know, and then if he was disturbed, he wouldn't have been satisfied with what he had and then want to reach true satisfaction.
I agree, but hang on. It's 1 o'clock in the morning. It's very, very dark. You're in the middle of a maze of alleyways. And this one was pretty Bernard Street, was no longer there, and I think it's called Henriquez Street now. You're in a maze of alleyways. Yes, of course, someone might have come along, but equally someone might not. I'm only being fair to those people who say about this particular case that actually it might not have been.
No, but it does make sense if that, you know, from an analytical point of view.
But what then became very significant was, for the first time, the name Jack the Ripper entered
the public
domain.
Mm.
That weekend, a letter and then a postcard were sent to the Central News Agency. The first letter is famously called Dear Boss. It literally is addressed Dear Boss. And it's signed Jack the Ripper. It also says that I'm going to cut off the ear of my next victim. Now, actually, Catherine Eddowes' ear wasn't cut off, but it was cut almost immediately afterwards. The so-called Saucy Jack postcard was sent, again to the Central News Agency, in the same handwriting, bragging and signed by Jack the Ripper. That was the first time that the Whitechapel murders were translated into the killings of Jack the Ripper. Until that point, it wasn't true.
Typical serial killer behaviour.
Well, it's important also to say that we are in the very beginnings of the popular press. And let me just get this out of the way at once. Nunes has started Titbits. Alfred Harmsworth, Titbits was the first of the popular press. It was essentially snippets of information.
Like a gossip magazine.
I think gossip magazines now are rather more elegant than Titbits was. It was basically little cuttings about who did what and what. Harmsworth, later to become Lord Rothermere, had started the beginnings of what was the tabloid press. You suddenly have a series of killings in the East End of London, which are sensational. You have to add in another ingredient, and for all those experts, please forgive me if I'm generalising. When Catherine Eddowes' body was discovered, there was a leather apron with it, and there was also some graffito on the wall in chalk. And that graffito suggested that it could have been the Jews. The Jews take no blame for anything. Now, there had been riots in the East End of London against the huge Jewish population. It was a very tense time. And the Commissioner of the Metropolitan Police ordered that the graffito should be obliterated.
Well, they just rubbed it out.
They rubbed it out.
And they never reported it. They didn't include
it. It was reported, but only subsequently.
They didn't include it in the investigation.
No.
Interesting.
So, I'm not suggesting for a moment, far be it, that there was anything to do with anti-Semitic feeling, but there was a very great sensitivity about anti-Semitic feeling in the East End at that time, because there had been this incredible influx of Jewish immigrants from the pogroms in Poland and also from Germany. So you've got these layers of things laid on top of each other. You have deprivation. You have uncertainty about the population, and you have what seems to be a serial killer, and then you have a new tabloid press that is effectively stoking the fire. Now, there can be no doubt that the Metropolitan Police did not play a blinder, to put it politely. They did their best, but they were utterly, utterly out of their depth. As Molly quite rightly says, no DNA, no CSIs, no forensic pathologist, not even any fingerprinting, nothing.
That wasn't their fault, though.
No.
Just, we didn't have technology.
Well, they didn't have the technology, but it would be fair to say there wasn't even, and to be fair, and again, those of you who know the story well will remind me, that at least one of the victims had been seen with a man before, shortly before her death. And then another of the victims had been seen with a man. One was described as shabby genteel. One was described as well-to-do. One was described as scruffy. There wasn't even a drawing. There was no photo.
No e-fit.
There was no e-fit. You're joking. There's no photo fit. There's not even a sketch. They didn't do that.
The shabby genteel fellow.
So you now have, and you, please, you can argue amongst yourselves, was it 6 killings? Was it 4 killings?
By the same person.
Was there a serial killer, or was it simply coincidence? And one of the fascinating things...
That can't be coincidence.
...about these killings is that the theories literally mount up. It was one person, it was 3 people, it was a conspiracy, they mount up all the time. And one of the things that makes the Whitechapel murders so compelling is that they are, in a way, mysterious to this very day. I mean, what have we had? Amelia Fox and David Wilson giving us another theory on BBC One.
Oh, yeah, she did host
within
that
the last 6 months.
Ah,
we've got to the bottom of it at last. I agree with those who harumph. Absolutely not. I didn't believe a word of it. But nevertheless, it incites your interest. There is something so fascinating about these series of killings in the East End in a very restricted area of London that resonate to this day. I mean, there have been 40, 50 books. I've watched 3 television documentaries made in the last 5 years this week. I mean, the interest never, ever goes away.
Do you think that's because it's unsolved? We've talked about this before.
Yeah.
Like Bible John, or the unsolved ones are always...
Mr. Kipper.
Yeah, I mean, it's the... Those are the
Jill
ones.
Jill Dando.
Exactly. All really pique the imagination, because it's that thing of how did they get away with it? Like, how do you get away with doing something and then disappear back into society, and then that person is still, everyone knows what they're capable of, and they're still amongst you?
Well, it's a complicated one. But let's just do the last of the so-called canonical 5.
Oh, yeah, sorry.
Mary Kelly is by far the youngest of the victims. She was only 25. She'd also had a relatively stable relationship until 2 weeks before she met her death. She wasn't as perhaps unstable as some of the others. She was the most brutally killed. It was Friday... the 9th of November, 1888, when a man who'd been sent round to collect her rent looked through the ground floor window of her room and saw her mutilated, brutalised body lying on her single bed.
Is she the only one who was killed inside?
Yes. You could take what you like of that.
Well, there's no pattern to any of it. Well, there's sort of pattern, but not as much pattern as you might
I think
expect.
One of the patterns that the pathologist said, that they were all lying down when they were killed. Their throats were cut
first.
But
they hadn't been, like, hit over the head, or, like, how'd you get them to lie down?
No. Well, the implication always was that there was some kind of sexual offering.
But it would, yeah, but you have to force the person into the laying down position.
I can't answer.
Or unless he's like lie down or I'll kill you, and then he did it anyway.
It could be all of that. Yeah. But the important point is that this was, if you like, the escalation theory that we're now so familiar with from Criminal Minds and all of the above, you know, the killer gets more and more and more vicious. Mary Kelly was absolutely horrifically mutilated. Her face effectively was cut off. Her breasts were cut off. Bits of her body were stuck, you know, on the side of the bed. And her heart was stolen. Her heart was never found.
Taken away. That is horrible.
She was the youngest. She'd been in a relationship, and it would subsequently emerge, and I'm not suggesting who the Ripper was, that her partner may have been responsible for her killing. I'm not attributing...
What? So...
It's only suggested.
We're not getting onto the suspects yet.
It's a bit early. But what we have now is at least 7 killings in a very small area. If you, you know, literally, if you walked out of here 20 minutes, almost all of them, all of the killings would have been literally 100 yards away. Only one, which is rather further, was Mitre Square, which is where Catherine Eddowes was discovered. That's in the City of London, but all the rest were in Whitechapel. But it's only on the edge of the City of London. So you have 2 possible killings, Emma Smith and Martha Abram. Then you have the 5 so-called canonical killings. And by this time, the police service, the Metropolitan Police Service, are aware. They have a lot on their hands. There is an outcry. Illustrated London News, the new tabloid press. This is beyond the beyond.
But it would be if it happened now. Imagine with Instagram and Twitter and...
It would have been quicker.
Info would have got around faster. But it would. You would have that. If there was someone killing... people at that degree, at that speed, in central London now, or any city.
Well, hang on a minute. Peter Sutcliffe managed to kill 13 sex workers in Leeds, Bradford and Halifax. And it took us, 4 years to find him?
Yeah, I don't mean the catching part. I mean the spreading of the fear of the...
Well... all I would say is it's extremely difficult. These are apparently, that's my victimology point, these are apparently random killings.
Yeah, no, I know, I appreciate it.
There's nothing connecting any of these women to each other. They haven't all been in a home together. They don't know the same people. They don't know they are... apparently utterly random.
Well, we don't know.
We don't.
We don't know what if they had any connection. We'll never know.
But they might have done. And so we have these extraordinary set of killings. And you've got the Dear Boss letter sent before Catherine Eddowes' body is discovered. You have the Saucy Jack postcard, again to the Central News Agency, again signed by, quotes, Jack the Ripper. And you have another letter. This one, because they, in Whitechapel, had formed a vigilante committee. And George Lusk, who was head of the Whitechapel Vigilante Committee, because they were genuinely terrified. I mean, it was an extraordinary sensation. he gets a letter, the so-called From Hell letter, which then became the name of a book and indeed a movie. The From Hell letter suggests that he can do whatever he wants. I can get away with anything.
He's playing God.
Yeah.
Well, it's always about power and...
It's always about power and control.
God complex, etc.
But hang on, I accept that. But power and control is one thing. Taking a person's life, particularly a woman's life, is one thing. But eviscerating them
in
such an extraordinary way is a very remarkable, powerful thing to do. I mean, it almost is so depraved, it almost defies belief.
No, I agree with you.
You know, you...
The practicality of it is, anybody who does that.
And bear in mind, too, that he disappears. The body's discovered, gone. Yes, of course, it's dark, and yes, of course, there are only gas lights and not many of them, but disappears.
Well, he must have known the territory well.
Well, that was to become significant because the police naturally assumed that he must be a local.
Yeah, you would, because how would you be able to...
Disappear so quickly.
Exactly. If you didn't know where you were, didn't know the area well. Also, you'd have to sort of stake out those people. It can't be random, can it? I mean, could it have been random?
I can't really tell you.
No, I know, but I just feel like you'd probably plan it.
Would you?
Well, you would plan that you were going to go and do something brutal. You would be like, I'm going out with it. You've got to take the stuff with you. You can't just be... If you're going to go and cut someone's heart out, you don't just, like, grab a knife from nearby. You know.
Well, I'm not...
It's premeditated.
Well, of course it's premeditated, and I don't wish it for a moment to suggest. But how premeditated was it? Was it just a bloodlust? Was it just the fact that this man, and we have to assume for a moment that it was a man...
Must have been a stressor. It would be one of those situations where, like, he had a mum complex, and every time his mum shouted at him, he, like, went out and... It's true. I've heard this before.
I'm not going to get into that one, darling.
I know, but there will be always a stressor.
Sure. Of course. But this is quite a prolonged stressor.
No,
it's gone on from August to November.
No, I know, but that's what, I mean, there are triggers.
You know, there are always triggers, but what makes this so signal and in many ways so interesting is that it's over a prolonged period of time. Yeah, okay, we can do lots of American serial killers in the 20th century, but this is almost the first time that we have a concentrated series of killings in a small part of East London. What is going on there? Is it about women? Is it about hatred? Is it about madness? And when we get to the suspects, I'll see if I can answer some of those questions. Mm-hmm. But we ought to just go on a little bit. The Metropolitan Police Service, having originally given the case to H Division, Whitechapel, decided to send some men from the Central Command in Scotland Yard.
Just over the road in Westminster.
Including the...
W Division.
The now famous Inspector Frederick Abilene, who has become a figure of considerable interest. But in fact, Abilene interviewed many people, but came up with no single convincing suspect. Yes, lots of possibles, And there were four other detective inspectors sent to help. In the end, the assistant commissioner at the Met, Sir Melville McNaughton, those of you who know the Ripper case will know that this is one of the most controversial parts of it. In 1894, 6 years after, insisted that there were only five Ripper killings and came up with a series of three suspects. He asked the police surgeon, Thomas Bond, what he thought. Bond wrote to the earlier head, a man called head of the CID at the Metropolitan Police Service, Robert Anderson, in a letter in November 1888. And Bond said, in specific terms, there were only five victims of the so-called Jack the Ripper. He dismissed, and there were then, after the killing of Mary Kelly, there were four further killings. Rose Myatt, Alice McKenzie, the so-called Pinchin Street Torso, and Francis Coles. The Pinchin Street Torso, let's just deal with it at once, was found in Pinchin Street in Whitechapel without any limbs. There were a number
head, no arms, no legs.
No, there were a number of other torsos found at around the same time. One in particular in the works in what was become New Scotland Yard or Scotland Yard. They found some in the basement. Another torso.
They found some torsos.
Yeah, and.
Surely
believe it or not,
the Pinchin Street torso be included in the Ripper.
Well, it was because it was in the same geographical location.
That was a whole nother serial killer.
Yeah,
torso. Somewhere.
In fact, that case became known as the Torso Killer.
Well, makes sense.
There were. I mean, that was part of what you might describe as the Whitehall mystery. Okay. The Whitechapel Vigilante Committee, Inspector Abilene, the whole panoply of the tabloid press, the new tabloid press. There is an extraordinary fascination with what on earth could be going on. Well, to be absolutely fair, the Metropolitan Police interviewed 76 butchers and slaughterers, because it was assumed that someone who'd inflicted these dreadful injuries
had
some sort of anatomical
skills.
Queen Victoria, who after all had been on the throne for
your favourite monarch,
came to believe that the murderer might have come on the cattle boats from the continent.
They would have come from the continent. Send them back, that's what we should have done.
Because
what they would have done back
they
then.
Used to arrive on Thursdays and Fridays and leave on Saturdays and Sundays to go back. And all the murders were committed at weekends or holidays.
Oh, that's interesting.
The Metropolitan Police, to give them their entire due, interviewed every single cattle boat, all the people who worked on them, and had worked on them for the previous 6 months, and not one matched. Not one.
We've got a lot of work to do.
And bear in mind, the number of officers that were now being devoted. I think it started at 30, it went to 90, it went to 180.
Yeah, you need a lot of men on the job to.
Well, it's because there's no computer, you can't click enter.
No, but even now you would need a lot of people on the ground doing that kind of work, to go door to door, to ask questions, you know, all of that.
Yes.
Interviews.
Yeah.
Just takes so much time.
But Thomas Bond, who was the police surgeon, told the then head of the CID that he believed absolutely that the five canonical killings were the work of one man. Now, other people subsequently have said that's not true. Elizabeth Stride may well not have been. Then Polly Nicol might not have been too.
This is all based on the way that they were killed.
It's based on the mythology.
And what happened.
Yes, it's based on the modus operandi. Bond rejected the idea without question that whoever had done these dreadful murders had any kind of anatomical expertise at all.
You'd have to have some to know where the kidney is or the heart. I mean, I know we know where the heart is, but you'd have to have... It's quite specific.
Well, there are very vivid drawings at the time of the Ripper pulling the intestines out of these women. Now, I'm not equipped to judge. But Bond, and again, this is contemporary, he had examined five of the victims, said he thought it was what he called periodic attacks of homicidal and erotic mania.
Sexual motive.
Well, that's another complication. There was no evidence whatever, in spite of the fact that three of the victims had their skirts pulled up, of any kind of sexual activity. None. Now, you could argue, we would argue in contemporary formulation that, well, maybe just derive some kind of sexual satisfaction from destroying a woman in front of him. But there's no evidence whatever. We don't have DNA. We don't have... You could ask, and it would be perfectly fair to ask, did posing the women, and which they all were posed to some extent, did posing them on their backs, you know, their skirts lifted up, was that something significant, or was it just happenstance? I can't tell you. No one can.
There's got to be some... There's too many similarities for it not to... You know, everything means something, I think.
Well, it nowadays, you know, we would have the benefit of, you know, all kinds of elaborate analysis of...
They didn't draw the scenes of the crime either, because now we take photos. They didn't like...
They took photos of the victims.
They did.
There's a very famous photograph of the last victim, Mary Kelly, which is the worst.
We don't have it because it's too grim.
No, it's too grim. I'm sorry we were not showing it. Because she was so brutally mutilated. So you have that... You have the question, well, why? So I'm really leading into part two.
Chat about who it might be.
Okay. The number of named suspects is over 100. There were reportedly several hundred letters written by Jack the Ripper to the Metropolitan Police.
Oh, but the ones we've seen are the only ones that have been published.
The ones that I've referred to, which is Dear Boss, Saucy Jackie, and From Hell.
Okay.
Dear Boss gained traction because of Edo's and the claim of clipping the lady's ears. But the lady's ears weren't taken off. But that was the first time that the words Jack the Ripper were used. The Saucy Jack postcard talked about the double event this time, the double event of the two killings discovered on the same night. And the From Hell letter sent to George Lusk of the Whitechapel Vigilante Committee was sent along with a box containing a left kidney, half a left kidney.
Oh.
Catherine Eddowes had lost.
We don't know if it was Catherine's kidney.
We do know, because a doctor at the time established that it was certainly a left kidney. We also know that the said letter suggested that he'd eaten the other
half
of the kidney.
It's a bit much. Didn't know he was a cannibal, or maybe he's a cannibal. Who knows? It's all speculation.
Well, let's just go back for a moment, and then we'll break. In the years afterwards, a lot of people confessed to writing From Hell.
The letters.
Dear Boss and Saucy Jack.
For what reason? To capture public imagination?
To sell more newspapers.
Oh, okay.
A journalist called Tom Bullen in 1913 was, and those of you who know the case well will immediately recognise it. Another journalist in 1931 called Fred Best said he wrote it for the Star, signed it Jack the Ripper to heighten interest in the case. It would be fair to say that the Ripper wasn't the first serial killer. There had been others. But what is undeniably true is that this one never, ever goes away. So, the suspects.
We'll do next.
We'll do next.
We're going to have a short pause and you can all go and get another drink or something. And we'll be back in
20 minutes.
Yes.